Let's head to my conversation with CBS Chief Foreign Affairs Correspondent Margaret Brennan, moderator of Face the Nation Sundays on CBS. I wanted to begin by asking Margaret about the latest news from the war in Gaza. President Biden with some serious criticisms this week for Israel Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. So Margaret gave us details on that.
We know what the White House has said, which is that in this 45-minute phone call, President Biden laid out a number of very specific demands in terms of finally delivering on the multiple requests for more humanitarian aid deliveries into the besieged Gaza Strip. So it was not just this one strike on the 7 humanitarian workers working for World Central Kitchen, which the Israeli military today said was a mistake, and they've punished multiple officials and soldiers, including removing two of them and upgrading three others who were involved in the drone strike. But they also have said that they will open three new gateways into the Gaza Strip to allow humanitarian aid convoys in. The Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, overnight, who was on that phone call with Netanyahu and Biden, said that the proof will be in what comes in the next days and weeks, specifically the metrics. How many aid trucks are allowed in? Will the security of those aid workers be protected? Will they be permitted to move into places like the north of the Gaza Strip, which is just really in famine-like conditions? And whether those metrics that indicate famine will be reversed. In other words, this is not success at this point. This is the beginning of a process that the Biden administration has frankly been pressing for months now. Netanyahu government also says they will change internally how their own government handles humanitarian aid. It'll now be in the hands of the war cabinet and not the far right wing ministers who make up the 8-person Netanyahu cabinet.
Is that how these mistakes happen? The fact that the right wing government was in charge of this and not the war cabinet? I'm trying to understand the difference between the two.
Well, so this is a prime minister in a parliamentary system in Israel. The coalition government that Netanyahu set up is the most far right wing in Israeli government history. Mm-hmm. He has made himself an ally of some of these extremist ministers. I'm thinking of people like Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, the finance and national security ministers, who have said things like Palestinians should be removed from Gaza, who have done things like blocking U.S. taxpayer-funded flour deliveries from making it in. Those people on that 8-person cabinet now will not be able to vote or weigh in on humanitarian aid deliveries. Those powers have now shifted to this emergency government, this war cabinet, a unity government that Netanyahu put together in the wake of those horrific October 7th attacks to make amends with some of those from opposite parties so that it would show Israeli unity. Those people in that 5-person cabinet will have control over humanitarian aid. Basically, it means Netanyahu can now be personally responsible for the aid.
I see. And we did talk briefly about the investigation into that drone strike that killed the aid workers. And it sounds like there was some spotting of individuals with guns. They thought they were in those vehicles. They didn't identify the vehicles as belonging to the World Central Kitchen. What more do we know about that?
Well, the investigation results that resulted in these punishments and firing of two Israeli soldiers have not been commented on in detail by the White House. The White House to date has not said they will conduct their own independent investigation. But remember, there was a dual U.S.-Canadian citizen among those dead. Mm-hmm. These are 7 workers who held European and Australian passports, but they are not the first aid workers. In fact, 200 or more have been killed since October 7th.
Is that right?
Trying to help people, according to the United Nations. Mm. And the aid workers that we've continued to have on Face the Nation from Save the Children, from Doctors Without Borders, have been telling us over these months just how dangerous and bad it is, and that this is unlike any war zone they have ever worked in before. And so we are going to have two of them join us this Sunday to ask them, is there a difference in these days since the Biden-Netanyahu phone call? Will we see a difference by Sunday? What is happening on the ground?
We're hearing from CBS Chief Foreign Affairs Correspondent Margaret Brennan, and I asked Margaret whether President Biden has threatened taking away any aid to Israel amidst the continued violence.
We've seen a shift in rhetoric that's gotten tougher. Actions, we haven't seen any. You had this phone call, and what we've seen since then are some vague comments from the Secretary of State and the Vice President and the White House spokesperson indicating there could be some change that happens if Israel doesn't take measurable action in the weeks and days ahead. That's not specific. We know that under U.S. existing law, the Foreign Assistance Act, the Leahy Act, the United States can suspend aid to countries that receive U.S. aid but then violate international law. The president also has his own national security standards that he issued back in February, which state clearly that if there is interference with aid delivery, that the United States can suspend support for that country. So there is the paperwork there, the legal basis by which to take it. It is a decision, a political and policy one, that is in the hands of the president. So he's threatening to do something, but is being completely unspecific as to what that would be.
And certainly higher stakes in an election year, too.
Exactly.
This Sunday, in addition to having those aid workers on with experience in Gaza, also the governor of Maryland will join you.
That is correct. The governor of Maryland, Wes Moore, will be with us, who is spending the day with President Biden, touring some of this devastation and what small measures of recovery have been able to be taken in the past few days to allow for smaller vessels to go through this waterway, which is such a key transit point for trade and for commerce in this country and certainly on the East Coast. President Biden has vowed that the federal government will not just help but pay for the recovery. We want to talk about what does that mean? And we'll talk about the impact locally as well.
Great show coming up this Sunday. Margaret, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
In the nation's northwest corner is Washington.
Our resident historian Felix Bunnell joins us every Friday morning for All Over the Map. This is a quick look at stories behind local places and things. And this week, the see-through uniforms of the Mariners road opponent tonight may say Milwaukee Brewers, but everyone knows that they're really the Seattle Pilots in disguise.
Yeah, I could talk about the Seattle Pilots for hours. You know, as many people know, the Pilots were our very first Major League Baseball team. We had them for one season back in 1969. They played at the old Six Stadium on Rainier Avenue, where the Lowe's Home Improvement Store now stands. They went bankrupt and were snatched up by Bud Selig in Milwaukee, since Milwaukee had lost the Braves to Atlanta a few years earlier, and they'd lost a team to St. Louis after one season way back in 1901. Here's the worst-kept secret in Major League Baseball. Baseball fans have been getting their hearts broken by teams leaving town for well over a century.
Oh.
Now, so just like that certain basketball team in Oklahoma is really the Sonics in disguise, a lot of people like to think that the Mariners, when they take the field in Milwaukee tonight against the Brewers, it's really two Seattle teams duking it out. Now, all this is a great excuse to play some vintage audio from the Pilots' very first game at the California Angels back on April 8th, 1969. That's 55 years ago this Monday. I don't have any home team KVI audio, but I do have Dick Enberg on KMPC Los Angeles with some highlights. Here's that very first game getting underway.
Jim McLaughlin to pitch for the Angels. Tom Satriano down in his crouch to give the sign. Nestor Shylock, the plate umpire, says play ball. The windup, the pitch, and Tommy Hopper lines one foul down the right field line, and the 1969 Angel season is alive. McLaughlin administers the first heartbeat to the brand new Seattle Pilots.
Oh,
what a great line. Dick
Enberg
making his debut as a Major League Baseball announcer.
Are you taking notes, Tom?
Yeah, I remember Tommy Hopper. He was a stolen base king for the Pilots.
He led that year, And Tommy Hopper actually got on base with a double in that first at bat in the first inning. And then Mike Hegan, well, he stepped up to the plate.
Swung on, long drive to right center field. It's very deep. Back to the wall is Johnstone. Hegan will cut them all. Seattle 2, the Angels nothing. On a double by Hopper, a home run by Hegan, and the Pilots are very much alive and early, and as predicted. And Don, this has to bring back memories from 9 years ago.
You know, it's kind of like the Mariners. They scored four runs that first inning, then it was just no more offense for the rest of the game. But they did hold on to win that inaugural game 55 years ago Monday.
Chopped down the third baseline. Rollins has it on two hops. His long throw in time, and the Seattle Pilots jubilantly leap in the air. They have won their first game ever, and it's a clean sweep for all the new franchises as the Pilots minutes in the final game to go into the books on this opening night. Follow the lead taken by the Montreal Expos, the Kansas City Royals, the San Diego Padres, and now it's the Seattle Pilots who tonight in Anaheim Stadium before 11,930 fans defeat the Angels 4-3 on four first-inning runs with a total zero.
Now, they finished a dismal 64-98, and they had a hard time selling enough tickets and making enough money. So in 1970, at the end of March, when the buses headed north from spring training, they could have turned left and gone to Seattle. Instead, they turned right and went to Milwaukee. It was really that last minute. Pilots became the Brewers on April 1st, played their first game on April 7th in hand-me-down uniforms with the Pilots thing torn off, and it was insane. Now, the Brewers finished their first season 65-97. 64, they improved,
by one game.
Now, Washington Attorney General Slade Gorton sued Major League Baseball, and the city was awarded the franchise. It became the Mariners, and they debuted in 1977. I've got links to several stories I've done about the Pilots over the years at My Northwest. I also fantasize about the Mariners someday beating the Pilots, excuse me, the Brewers, in the World Series. Wouldn't that be cool? Two Seattle teams, cool. we couldn't lose. Now, let's go out singing the Pilots theme song together.
Sure.
If you don't know the words, just make up the obscene lyrics I usually sing at home. It's called Go, Go, Ye Pilots.
Oh, that's a catchy,
you know,
catchy ditty.
If I can add one note, that season spawned one of the most controversial peel-back-the-curtain books of all time in baseball at that point, Ball 4 by Jim Boughton.
What a great book, yeah.
Who was with the team at that time and wrote about all of the, we'll say, peccadillos that the players had as they were on road trips and things like that and things that they did. And behind-the-scenes look at the manager, Joe Schultz, and his he used to say, go pound that bud.
Yes. Okay. What's that book called again?
Bud, Ball 4.
The weekend is here. Cairo News Radio's Paul Holden has the latest on big things happening in town.
Friday then, this Saturday, Sunday, what? This Friday then, this Saturday, Sunday, what?
It's the weekend yet again, and that means lots of things going on in the region. So if you need plans, get out your notepad and take some notes. It's the Seattle Deaf Film Festival this weekend at the Northwest Film Forum, and it's a festival featuring films about, by, and for the deaf, deafblind, deaf-disabled, and hard-hearing community. Each film you see will be in sign language and have English subtitles. You can see the movies being shown and get more details at deafspotlight.org/SD. DFF. Take a night walk at the Seattle Chinese Garden with Astra Lumina. This multi-sensory experience features projections, special lighting, and theme music, all designed to make it feel like you're walking amongst the stars. The walk takes about an hour, and it's the final weekend it's in town. Check out tickets on astralumina.com/Seattle. In Ballard, at the Ballard Northwest Senior Center, it's the Spring Rummage Sale. There will be all sorts of goods for sale, including jewelry, clothing, toys, collectibles, dishware, and more. There will also be food served at the cafe. The sale is today, 9 to 4, and tomorrow, 9 to 3. If shopping is on your mind this weekend, remember there are weekend markets in Fremont, Ballard, Capitol Hill, U District, and West Seattle every Sunday, and the Georgetown Trailer Park Mall on Saturdays and Sundays. Speaking of weekend markets, Cutie Fest is this Sunday at Cal Anderson Park from 10 to 5. Cutie Fest features over 300, yes, 300 artists and vendors showing off their work. There's no entry fee, and the vendors will be of all ages and identities. Check out Cutie Foundation on Instagram for more details. The Red Bull Lords of the Floor Dance Competition is back, and the 2v2 dance-offs will be going down at the WAMU Theater. 16 international duos will be showing off their breaking skills, and this is the perfect way to introduce yourself to the sport ahead of its debut at this year's Olympics. Lords of the Floor starts Saturday, and tickets can be found on Red Bull's website. It's the final weekend of the Seattle International Dance Festival Winter Mini Fest. You can experience contemporary dance and see performances that are created in just a few days. There are performances on Saturday and Sunday. You can get more details at seattleidf.org. The Seattle Sounders are in town this weekend, taking on CF Montreal. The match is Saturday night at at 7:30 p.m. at Lumen Field. The March to the Match will be at 6:30 p.m. from Occidental Park. Get tickets on the Sounders website. It's the first weekend of the Skagit Valley Tulip Festival. The festival runs throughout the month of April and will feature many different events. There's even a tulip bloom tracker and a rundown of the schedule on the website, which I highly recommend checking out before you go. That site is tulipfestival.org. These are just a handful of the events going on this weekend. If I miss something or you know about something cool going on, let me know at paulh@cairoradio.com. Paul Holden, Cairo News Radio.
Let's head to Washington, D.C., where Congress has a couple of big discussions underway. We're going to invite CBS's Scott McFarlane onto the show. Scott, good morning.
Hey, Colleen. Good morning.
Well, President Biden visiting Baltimore today. He has promised the federal government is footing the bill for this bridge rebuild. How's that coming along in Congress?
It should be easy. In any other moment in time, emergency money for a disaster swims through Congress without being interrupted. But this is not a normal Congress. It's gridlocked. It is, to be honest, dysfunctional. And there's concern that this is going to get jammed up, along with all the other basic things Congress and government should be doing. There are already a few wedge issues here. How much is immediately needed? Republicans have made the argument, including a Maryland Republican, that it's got to be less than $100 million to start, that they're not ready to get into the work of planning for rebuilding a bridge, that that's years away, and that there should be a requirement in any bill passed by Congress that any company found liable should be required to reimburse the feds, that it should be written into the bill. Mm. What's more, they want to change Biden administration policies about liquefied natural gas exporting, which seems a little bit off topic.
Yeah.
This is going to be a wedge issue, and you can just feel it coming down the pike. There's going to be disputes over how much to spend, what language should be in the bill, and what other types of political priorities should be thrown into it. Because here's the thing, Colleen. This is one of the few bills that actually could move. And when you have a bill that can move in an otherwise gridlocked Congress, people are going to want to throw a lot of non-germane things on top.
It's kind of sad, right? I mean, Baltimore is struggling. Multiple people died in this. And Congress wants to make this a political game of ping pong before they can fix Baltimore's bridge. To me, I don't know how anybody isn't having political repercussions for this.
I think you're spot on. First of all, the one sticky issue here is that this is not a natural disaster. This is a man-made one to a degree. It was a malfunction of some sort or a mistake made by someone or something. So there's going to be this dispute over should a private party be footing as much of this bill as possible and not the taxpayers. They're going to have to iron that out. And there may be some, nonpartisan, bipartisan discussion over that. But this is a more pernicious issue here. One of the Maryland Democrats who sits on the powerful Appropriations Committee, a man named David Trone, told CBS News yesterday he wants to draft some language into this bill that would require a future President Trump, if he wins re-election, to continue the work, to bind a future president to continuing the restoration, making the argument that this bill might need to be Trump-proofed because there's this concern, merited or not, Colleen, that there are now red state and blue state disasters, huh, and that people will only support emergency aid in a state of their color. It may be a flight of fancy, that idea, or it may be legitimate, but that somebody saying it out loud gives you a sense of how troubling and toxic a moment we're living.
I think I just said under my breath, that's insane. And it's sad. It makes me really sad for the future of this country that we would only be funding countries that match our political color. How have we ever had a time in history where a former president has this type of stronghold on Congress that while he has no power and authority over the country, he has this power and authority over a party that is making policy, is making laws, is holding up really important aid and work for our country? Has this happened before?
Not in modern times, not in our lifetimes. And I think one of the unique quirks of a president running for re-election after he lost is that he does have this unnatural, to a degree unprecedented, hold on his party before he gets to Election Day. And this is something we're watching for a first time. I mean, I give you the 20-second version of my upcoming feature report for CBS News. Yes. On Grover Cleveland, the one president who lost and then came back and won again. Grover Cleveland is the opposite of Donald Trump. He was trying to pull his party away from populism and change, trying to normalize his party Donald Trump is trying to push his party towards change and populism. All of this is unprecedented, even if you want to take out the quirks of the 19th century. This is just a different time. And I think a lot of people in Congress don't have their footing because they're not sure how to navigate all this.
Mm. And I understand there's also fighting over President Biden's stance right now in Israel. He had that 45-minute conversation with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in which he said, listen, if you don't open these ports, if you don't open these roads for aid, we may change our policy on Israel. Now, may being the operative word, but it is a stronger stance than we've seen from President Biden before. However, Republicans go, no, this isn't how this should be. What do the Republicans want done in Israel?
They're also, I think, trying to navigate this as well. I mean, Donald Trump gave a relatively equivocating and mushy criticism of Israel's war practices, too. So there's the concern from both parties. I think Republicans are trying to figure out how to speak out about it, but seem to be devoted to Israel. Democrats are grappling with that as well. There was a quick delivery from President Biden's call with Benjamin Netanyahu. They've opened up new channels for aid, new pathways for aid to get in. But the president's going to be under quite a bit of pressure over the next week or two as they try to figure out how much to spend on Israel and should there be restrictions on what that money is used for. Should it be for defensive purposes only? And if so, how do you write that into the law? This is really such a delicate political situation in addition to being a humanitarian crisis.
Absolutely. The question of, do you want U.S. aid and weapons being used to kill aid workers? That's a question in an election year that is a tough one for a president to face. Scott McFarlane, always enjoy our conversations. And I don't know if you mentioned when your special on Grover Cleveland is going to air. Why don't you let us know?
I will insist on coming on to promote the heck out of that thing, because I got to tell you, one of the most fascinating figures in American history, and very few people know who the heck he is.
Very true. All right. Well, let us know when it's going to air, and we'll have you on, okay?
Of course. Thanks, Colleen.
All right. Thanks, Scott. 7:37 now, your daily dose of kindness brought to you by Heritage Homecraft. A Spokane woman is being called a hero by dozens of children. Jan Ashley founded the organization Helping Them in 1998 after living in Kenya and seeing the needs of the people around her. She told Spokane TV station KHQ.
One of the biggest things that I saw at that time was medically was malnutrition. The children would have scabies all over their bodies.
Jan said it became her mission to help Kenyan girls who were at risk for abuse and other traumas find a safe place and inspiration for their futures.
So what has happened in this one area where I'm working right now, and that is that they started circumcising the younger children secretly. A little 8-year-old was married to an 80-year-old man.
Jan opened that rescue center in Kenya in 2010, hoping to help these girls find safety and shelter. She says about 80 girls are there right now.
In fact, I have a little girl right now, age 9. Her father circumcised her secretly. He married her off at the age of 11, and they began to abuse her.
Since relocating to Spokane in 2011, Jan continues to return to Kenya every year, 3 times a year, on her mission to connect with people and save at-risk children. During Jan's most recent trip, alumni from her center surprised her with several gifts to express their gratitude for her efforts. One of them is a portrait of Jan that reads, "Our heroine." Another, a shawl that includes Jan's maiden name and proclaims her a champion of children's rights.
To say thank you, and I just... there's no words to describe. You know, there's just no words.
Jan says about 30 people are welcome to join her on a trip coming up later this year to Kenya. If joining her mission interests you, you can learn more about her cause by going to her website, 4mdp.org. It's the number 4mdp.org. And you can always reach down the text line if you need that link. Thank you, Kate. 7:48 on Seattle's Morning News, and that music means our queen, Ursula Royteen, is here.
Good morning.
You smell so good.
Oh, thank you.
You always do.
It is Valaya.
Yeah, is that the perfume?
It is my signature scent now, and it is one that I tell everybody when they stop me and say, you smell good.
Yeah. You and
it's
G
really
both.
Good.
Just like the best smelling.
But then I always think, maybe I'm wearing too much,
no.
And I'm a little stuffed up today.
Oh. No, No. You smell good. I just want our listeners to know that in addition to being so kind and so talented, you also smell good.
Oh, thank you.
So there's some new signs out there that are watching our bad behavior. What's this about?
Yes. So it is a pilot project. The Traffic Safety Commission basically figures that these sensors, so you know those signs when you drive by and it tells you, oop, you know, 41 miles and you're supposed to be going 35 or less.
Yeah.
Well, it's similar to that. So it's infrared sensors that will basically tell you if they catch you using your phone, or if they catch you putting on makeup, or you know, whatever it is, if you are driving distracted. Now, Sully's going to help me technologically speaking in terms of how does it know?
Shoot infrared into your car,
yes.
And to see if your hands are not on the wheel, they'll assume, it'll say, get off the phone or put your phone down. It'll assume you're doing something other than driving, or it'll tell you you're speeding or something like that.
Yeah. And so they're not cameras. And so they're not going to have any personal information. So in case anyone thinks, well, that's an invasion of my privacy, that's not what this is. But it's essentially telling you, hey, you've got distracted behavior, you need to knock it off. Kind of like the same thing if you're speeding a little bit too much. Conversely, if you're doing a good job, you get a smiley face.
No way.
No, yeah.
That's funny.
Sully does not look amused.
So all of the people pleasers out there and all of the appraisal junkies will be looking for those smiley faces.
If you need validation, you're doing a good job.
Yeah.
So it's not only going to tell you when you're doing a lousy job, but it's also going to reward you when you do a good job. So there are going to be, let's see, they said there are going to be four different locations that they're going to start. You're going to see the signs through July. The first four locations are in Pacific, and then in Issaquah, on Front Street, on Milwaukee Boulevard and Pacific, in Seattle, on Airport Way, and then also in White Center. But they're going to try to do a bunch of different locations, I believe 12. And the whole idea is it's part of this whole bring down the number of driving-related deaths.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the number of people who died on Washington's roads last year, that was more than 800, and that's up from 11% from the year before. And even though the rest of the country is seeing a decrease just on average, we're seeing an uptick, which is something that Chris Sullivan has mentioned.
Three straight years where we've set records in Washington for the amount of people killed on our roads.
And didn't they divide out of those 800 killed, how many were distracted driving incidents?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, distracted is a big one. Impairments, obviously, a certain.
Yeah, 121 deaths were attributed to distracted driving.
Yeah, so.
So, I mean.
Those are preventable.
Exactly.
So is speeding.
Yeah.
Impairment.
Yeah.
Those are all choices. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, I'm not a big fan of this idea, as you can tell.
What I'm saying is the easier of the two, if you don't have an alcohol addiction problem, is get off your phone while you drive. Yeah, right.
Now, what would be the drawback other than cost?
I don't know.
What
okay, here we go. Da, 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 I'm looking at my phone. Oh my gosh, there's a sign over there. Sign telling me to do it. So it's a distraction to prevent a distraction.
But after the first time, I mean, do you act that way when you see that sign go up that says you're driving?
We like to call 42? Those, the technical term for those is your speed is signs. I'm not kidding. That's what they're called. Your speed is the ones that flash up.
Okay.
And do it.
Do you
it
react that way
down.
After?
It
kind
does,
of.
Because it does make me slow down.
It does for me, too.
So I'm thinking that after the first time you're surprised by it, I think it's a great idea.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It's hard because I'm prone to it too. I've looked at my phone. I've had to type in an address before. I've had to grab my phone and give it to my girls after turning on Netflix so that they can watch a show while we drive. You know, I've done things that count as distracted driving.
Me too.
And for me, just based on my own personality and relationship with my phone, I would need to put it all the way in the trunk for me to never touch it.
Yes.
While I drive.
And what I like about this is it is a gentle reminder. There's no traffic infraction involved.
Right.
It's a gentle reminder. And it's something that I have to remind myself because I so instinctively want to do. I want to multitask every time
Same.
I'm driving.
Same.
It's like, what the heck? And every time I do that, I stop and I tell myself, is your life not worth, or is someone else's life not worth?
Yeah.
You just stopping for a second?
To look at a text message
or
whatever.
Why was it so important to do that?
Well, we'll see if it helps. They're up now?
Yes.
Okay. I want to drive by one. I want a smiley face. Thank you, Ursula.
Oh, Sully.
She'll be with Mike Lewis coming up at 9 o'clock this morning. It is 8:15 on Seattle's Morning News. Colleen O'Brien, Sully here with you. And oh, I've been looking forward to this all morning. We are welcoming one of our former colleagues. You remember her from her illustrious career at Cairo News Radio, her hit podcast, Your Last Meal, and just a generally great person, Rachel Bell. Welcome back to Seattle's Morning News.
Pew, pew, pew. Hi, guys. I'm so excited to be here.
Were you trying to do like the Jamaican air horn, the wah, wah, wah? Is that what you were doing?
Yeah. Was that not just a perfect impression? I don't know. Yes. I was trying to be an air horn.
Oh, good. Okay. Rachel, we're having you on today. First of all, how are you?
I'm a little sick. I was hoping to come into the studio, but I'm okay.
And we're having you on because you're now a big TV star, girl.
I mean, at 8:50 p.m. tonight, I will be. My new show, The Nosh with Rachel Bell, is premiering on Cascade PBS tonight.
Tell us about The Nosh. So we know Your Last Meal, your podcast, where you ask famous people what their last meal would be, and then you go into the history and side stories about that food or that item. The Nosh is a bit different. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so it's a storytelling show, and we explore nature and art and community and different trends all through the lens of food and drink. So to me, it feels like all of the work that I've done all of these years when I was a feature reporter on Cairo and doing the podcast, I'm interviewing people, I'm storytelling, but now my face for radio is on the TV.
Oh, whatever. They always say that about face for radio, but Rachel, you're beautiful through and through. Aww. What is it though, hosting your very first TV show? This is very different from your radio career.
It is. You know, it's very interesting. I feel like a lot of people start in TV or in entertainment, visual entertainment, when they're younger. And so I'm 44 and I just think it's a little bit interesting. I went to Sephora and got a makeup lesson because I realized I've been doing my makeup the same way since high school. So yeah. I'm going to figure that out. There's things I've thought about as far as, you know, we live in a country that can not be the nicest to the aging process of women on TV. And the thing that I've done just mentally is to channel Julia Child. Mm. She is the only person that I've ever considered a hero. And I love the fact that her first cookbook didn't come out till she was 49. And she wasn't on TV until she was 51. And that was also on PBS. So I just feel like I'm in the house of Julia Child. I can't believe that I'm actually, you know, working for the same company that she did. And Julia Child didn't get Botox, and America loved her. So
I support you.
What I'm leaning on.
That's amazing.
Oh, no, Rachel, Sully here. I'm a little disappointed to hear that I wasn't your hero. No, it's great to hear
from
you.
You're number two.
Yeah, thank you. In many ways. The thought, I'm not a big cooking show kind of guy. I'm used to kind of what I see on the Food Network things that Holly watches. What you're going to have like demonstrations and things as well in addition to, I mean, kind of, you know, you kind of talked a little bit about the content, but what kind of other thing kind of specifically will we get to see?
Yeah, so it's not a cooking show and it's not a restaurant review show. For example, the first episode is all about bagels because I hear this constantly. People are always telling me there's no good bagels in Seattle, or they're asking me, where can I get a good bagel? And since the pandemic started, there has been a lot of new bagel shops that have opened that are really, really good. And so the first episode is just highlighting a couple of places, talking about, you know, does it have to be on the East Coast? Do we need the East Coast water? Is there a West Coast style? So yeah, less about, even though you'll always see a tasting moment and you're going to see the food being prepared sometimes, more just kind of hearing people's stories. So that's the first episode.
And we have a little bit from the first episode. You want me to play it?
Sure.
Okay.
All right, so Rachel, you know my position on this. There are no good bagels in Seattle. I grew up on New York bagels.
Yeah.
I'm very spoiled. So I have a very high bar coming in here.
I know, but I brought you here to prove you wrong.
Ooh, prove him wrong. Where'd you bring? Can you tell us where you went at all? I want a good bagel.
No, you got to watch the show. I can't give it all away.
Let's talk about when the show airs.
Yeah. So there are four episodes. Each airs every Friday in April. And you can watch on Channel 9, Cascade PBS, at 8:50 p.m. on Fridays, or you can watch from anywhere online. So if you go to cascadepbs.org and just scroll down a teeny bit to the original programming, it'll be right there.
And I feel like 8:50 p.m. on a Friday is a great way to watch this before you may go to bed. And it'll give you an idea for maybe what you want to eat the next day. Go to a bagel shop the next morning. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I was thinking of you need to have one when you're watching, though, because people, everybody who I work with who's been editing, everyone's like, God, this makes me hungry. I want a bagel so bad. So I recommend that you maybe get a bagel today if you're going to watch tonight, or watch tomorrow with a bagel in hand. Yeah. And then other things we get into, I'm sure you guys might have covered this by now, too, is the non-alcoholic movement is getting so popular. So we have an episode about that. There's an episode with hunting for truffles with dogs. And then we have an episode about, I think you have a clip for this as well, food as art.
Here in Seattle, a city famous for coffee, we have grown accustomed to that ubiquitous little heart swirled into the foam of our lattes. But if you're able to see it with fresh eyes, that cup of coffee is a tiny work of art. At Leon Coffee House, a Mexican cafe in the U District, they take latte art to the next level, delighting customers with their cute foamy creations and flavors like horchata, mango, and Nutella. Every mug is like a miniature gallery. But these baristas aren't the only artists creating food and drink that's almost too beautiful to eat. I'm Rachel Bell, host of Your Last Meal
you
podcast
guys can pause it.
And long. You want me to pause it?
I accidentally sent you the long clip.
Okay. You're like, turn it off, turn it off. Yeah, Rachel, I just have to say, and this is a little self-indulgent, just, you know, working alongside you for so many years and having these conversations about what you want in life and what your vision is for your journalism and the food you love so much. When that TV trailer hit on social media, when you posted that and I saw you on TV walking through fields with people, standing alongside, you know, incredible bakers for these, I thought, this is Rachel's vision come to life. I mean, you manifested all of this into reality. And I know there's listeners on the text line right now going, it's Rachel Bell. Yay. I love Rachel Bell. And we're cheering you on. We're rooting you on. And I'm just so proud of what you've done.
Thank you so much. I mean, it is true. I've wanted to have a career solely in food media for at least 15 years. And, you know, I loved my experience working in news, but I'm really in the spot I've always wanted to be. So, yeah, I have the podcast still. This show is premiering. And then in November, my first cookbook is getting published. So
that's right. It's around tahini.
Tahini. Yeah. Tahini and sesame. It's called Open Sesame. So I just am swimming in food right now. And I've never been happier.
Okay, Rachel, I've got one request. As the over 50-year-old guy who lives in the suburbs who only eats at chain restaurants, when are you going to do a feature on that?
Applebee's?
I want you to do a feature on the expanding your palate to chain restaurants instead of all these really fun artisan places that I could never get to.
Okay, well, you'll have to be my Sherpa. You'll have to be my guide. You'll be like, so where are we going? What's your favorite chain restaurant?
I'm going to get to Applebee's. After 9 o'clock, it's just the B when they lower the lights and it gets a little crazy.
After dark.
Yeah, it's the B after
in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
That's amazing. I would love to see that.
A lot of the chains actually have interesting stories, not all of them, but I interviewed the guy who does all the food for the National Cheesecake Factory chain. And I was so surprised to learn that they actually in every location make everything from scratch every day.
What?
Like every salad dressing, every sauce. I know some of the other restaurants do not do this, but I have a new respect for the Cheesecake Factory, which also started as a small business.
Wow. See, that's there's awesome. Room for everyone in
that's
the food
awesome.
World.
So happy for you, Rachel. This is great.
I know.
Thank
I feel
you
like
so much.
Jumping up and down. And again, the texters just pouring in about, you know, yay, Rachel, what a treat to have her. And aww. So if you want to keep supporting Rachel, her first episode of the Nosh premieres on Cascade PBS at 8:50 tonight. You can go to cascadepbs.org to look that up. There's four episodes this season. There's going to be eight episodes next season. And you also have your cookbook coming out in November. You said
that's right, with Sasquatch Books. I just want to say that I appreciate every single listener, because if I didn't have these listeners supporting me all these years, I wouldn't have been able to get here. And I really, really mean that. So thank you so much for everyone supporting and all your sweet social media messages. And I'm really excited to have everyone behind me.
We love you, Rachel. Thanks for joining
us. I love you too. Thank you.
All right, take care. 8:49 on Seattle's Morning News. Colleen O'Brien here, David Burbank, Kate Stone, Chris Sullivan, Mickey Gomez. Even here, we've got a total full studio.
Nothing I can say, a total eclipse of the heart.
Bonnie Tyler. We're here to talk about the total eclipse. Mm-hmm. And we can't really see it from our state, right? It's not going to be a total eclipse in our state. It's
not.
Probably going to be cloudy.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have better news?
Well, if you're east of the Cascade Mountains, you'll be able to see it beautifully.
Okay.
Or at least the bottom part of it, where it's going to cover, I believe that the, and if I get it wrong, I'm really sorry, when the moon is passing in front of the bottom of the sun, that's when we'll get the half eclipse.
Oh, so we get at least a half.
At least a little bit. So it's going to begin at like 10:39 a.m. It's supposed to peak at 11:29, and then it'll be over by 12:21.
And this is Monday.
This is Monday.
Okay, so we would have to ditch work and maybe head to the other side of the state in order to see it. Okay.
Probably. Or if you're here in Seattle, pray for sunny skies. Pray for, you know, the clouds to lift and, and be like, oh, look, what's all that blue up there?
Yeah, I remember the last one. This was back in, was it October? Because we were going out to the Carter Subaru tree planting
2017?
There was some sort of eclipse last fall, I thought.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe it was two
falls ago.
Because I remember looking at the sky and like trying to get a picture without looking at the sun.
Mm-hmm.
And it can create really cool shadows, too. Like if you bring out a disco ball or a mirror, like you can do it that way as well.
Yeah. I remember seeing all of the Facebook posts of people, you know, look at my shadow and look at all the, it looks like leaves on the cement or whatnot. Yeah. I remember that. Mm-hmm.
It's a good one.
Yeah. But according to Axios, if the clouds break and we have the clear skies, we should be able to see the moon passing in front of the bottom of the sun, which will look really cool. But there are about what makes Monday's eclipse so popular is that more people will be able to view it in the middle of the state. 31.6 million people are going to be able to see the eclipse. We're talking about like Oklahoma, Missouri, Arkansas, like Indiana, Ohio, even Texas. Like there are small towns.
Mm-hmm.
Where people are like, it's supposed to pass in the middle of our town. We're supposed to be completely in the dark. This has never happened before. And they've got like tourism headed to their city and they're so excited about it.
Have you heard of this so-called cicada apocalypse that's supposed to happen after the solar eclipse? That this will trigger the cicadas to wake up and wreak havoc?
It's supposed to be one of the
Mayan Aztec
theory. No, it's supposed to be one of the bigger cicadan resurrections in forever.
Yeah.
Like a whole bunch of them are coming due. For those of you that have never lived on the East Coast or the Southwest or Southeast, they're basically an underground kind of like locust grasshoppery type of thing that stays dormant, and then every so often they all just decide to come up out of the ground and take over.
And
that's about
loud.
To happen.
This sounds
yeah, clouds of local. Yeah, it's just,
into the world kind of a thing.
Yeah,
no,
it's supposed to be a really like large, like all of them are doing it as opposed to just some groups. Yeah,
there's a movie about that, and it doesn't end well.
Last time this happened, they figured out how to like make them into meals and stuff. Like there's just so many cicadas, they started eating bugs. It was. I don't know what happens, but that's supposed to happen after the solar eclipse.
Well, thanks.
So I guess be glad we live on the West Coast.
Is there an explanation for why the eclipse would trigger that? Do you know, Chris?
I'm not that much of a meteorologist. It's time to call. We have to reach out to Nick and see if there's some correlation there. But again, I don't know. I have no idea.
Have you ever watched a solar eclipse before?
Yeah, we saw the one in 2017. I sat with the Department of Transportation workers at the Shoreline office. I was doing a choke point interview there, and then they're like, hey, and the whole building came out, and we watched it together with a whole bunch of DOT workers.
It's actually really cool. The community aspect of it. Yeah, I was working at a Starbucks at the time, and all the cars that were going through the drive-thru stopped. Everyone got out of their car. Everyone got out of the building. You all put on your glasses and looked up at it. It's a really fun sort of joining. Obviously, this one's not going to be that way for us, but it is kind of a cool event to all gather around.
Yeah. I remember in elementary school, I just looked it up and they said that because of climate change or because maybe the temperature of the earth during the eclipse, that might be the reason why the cicadas wake up. And then when they wake up, they mate.
Ooh, they're expecting 100 trillion to come up out of the ground.
Yeah, I just read. Yeah, 100. My toes just curled.
Well, sorry to make a really fun celestial event gross, but this is what I do as a news person.
Now I'm really happy that we live here.
Exactly. Well, thank you, Mickey.
Hey, you're welcome.
So head over to the east side of the Cascades if you want to view our tiny bit of eclipse that's going to happen and hope that the clouds part.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you will never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.